Only those of the staff, management, or ownership of WGCH Radio.
Welcome to A View of World Affairs from Greenwich. Politics, economy, history. A careful examination of the world's interrelationships and how they affect us, here in our country as well as here in Greenwich. And now here is your host, Fotis Baliakas.
Good morning, Greenwich listeners. Fotis Baliakas here from WGCH AM 1490 Radio. Hope you all well rested for a nice sunny weekend. We have prepared a program for you today as a continuation from last week's diplomacy. We will examine the multilateral institutions that help with diplomacy and how the United States has conceived them, helped to create them, and now we depend on them for the world order. So we will continue. I will give you a little sequence of what the topics will be and what I mean by multilaterals, meaning that it has the participation of more than one party. These institutions have the ability to collect the world in a sequence of events that produces and takes input from everyone and produces results for everyone, hopefully. So we will talk about how, following the devastating wars of World War I and then World War II, how here in the United States, that we were totally isolationist at that time, especially prior to World War I, how we looked at the devastation of the world and decided, President Wilson, to take action. And then later on, President Roosevelt to take action. So we will talk about the League of Nations, the United Nations establishment, and with that, the World Court of Justice, the World Health Organization, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and other smaller, similar organizations, and why those are important to the world order that we have today. And why we depend on them. Are they effective? And I will tell you from the get-go, not all of them are effective. And we have many examples of that and how and there are ways of fixing that issue. Before I start with the genesis of all these multilateral organizations, a couple of things that they are up in my mind fresh as they're happening. A couple of weeks ago, in the war in Ukraine, after a long period of discussions and back and forth and a lot of political maneuvering, the EU states, NATO, and the United States decided to provide armaments, heavier armaments, i.e., tanks and wheeled armed vehicles to the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians really have proven themselves to be very good fighters, very smart, and the resistance is not just the resistance anymore as we were expecting as in counterinsurgency. They have taken back some of their land. But it's important to state a couple of things that are important on the issue of we giving them some of the tanks. So at the beginning of the war, the Ukrainians didn't have much of armaments. They had all Russian-made weaponry, you know, dating back from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. You know, the best platform could have been a T-72 tank, which was a derivative of the T-34 that started the counterattack to the Germans in 1942. So, you know, old established, very heavy machinery. Now, the Europeans have the Germans have the Leopard 2 and the French had the Leclerc. And obviously we have the M1A1, which is now M1A2 Abrams tanks. So, yeah, it's good to give them those tanks, absolutely, including the Challenger from England. But just bear in mind that these German and French tanks are not tested in real battle. The ones that are really tested in battle, the M1A1 and the Challengers, they faced real RPG fire, real live fire against them. So they may be regarded as the top five platforms in the world. They, if they have not been slapped in the face, they have not faced the enemy. So they will go out there, and I'm sure we will see how good they stack with the T-72s and the 92s from the Russian armaments. But just remember that the M1A1, it had only one casualty in the Iraqi war. If you remember 1991, it was a discussion. It was a fairly new tank at that time. It was a discussion that they will not last in the sands of the Middle East, and it will break down, and it will be... So the armaments are not only firing and protecting, but they have a protection on themselves. So the technology that we have is not only the armament around the tank is in steel, some rubber, but they have reactive armor. And that reactive armor is the technology that comes with it. The reactive armor looks around and sees threats incoming. And before the shells penetrate the steel, they explode outside the tank to make the incoming missile explode outside, not inside. So that technology, I don't think that will be transferred. And the rest of the I don't think the Challenger or the Leopard or the Leclercs have that, but we definitely have that, and that's the key. The Israeli Markava, which is a unique tank for their use in the Middle East and in Israeli territory, is unique, and that technology is there. So we will see now how all of those come together, and I just don't want to be in I would like to be actually a fly in the wall in some of these meetings that countries like India and others that have most of their armament from Russia and see how these things are not doing well in the war. How do they think about, have we made a mistake to put all of our eggs in that basket, and how do we reverse that? So it's these conflicts are proving the point, and Russia used Syria as a proving ground for their equipment as well. But obviously they're not doing as well. So that was just a thought that I had about these major tanks coming into the field and how effective they will be. I hope that they will be effective, but we will see qualitative we will reserve qualitative judgment to see how they go after they come in contact with the enemy. Another thing is, I think is going to happen, something that will give them some coverage in the air. Because this armored vehicles, they're susceptible to incoming threats by air. Missiles, even the simple RPGs. So we had a weapon that we took out of in the Air Force that we took out. It was the A-10 Warthog. Simple platform, built like a tank, but it flies. It loiters low. It's very slow. But what it did as that weapon, along with some helicopters, if you remember the 1991 war in Iraq, the Highway of Death. All the armaments from the retreating Iraqis were leading back to Baghdad from Kuwait, and they were all lined up in that highway, in that coastal highway going north. And we trapped them. And the Warthogs just had a turkey shoot to the point that strategically changed the war. Strategically changed the war. It forced President Bush to stop the war, because we were doing such a damage and a catastrophe to material and human lives. So that simple airplane, if that was given to the Ukrainians at the beginning, imagine what would have happened to those roads, the three roads leading from north from Belarus, from the northeast and east, leading to Kiev. All of these armored columns, miles and miles and miles, trapped. They couldn't go anywhere. They were trapped on that road, one way in, one way out. If that weapon was available to them, we wouldn't be in this situation right now. So, but there's still time. We have these airplanes mothballed in Arizona or New Mexico somewhere, collecting sun, and they could be in their hands. And that's even before we even go talk about the F-16, the bombing fighter platform that everybody knows, and it's one of the most successful airplanes, military airplanes. They're simple air hog, very cheap and easy to produce. And I understand that the Ukrainians back then in the 1991, they were trained on those. So it's an easy thing. It's an easy thing. Well, let's go back to diplomacy. And I also added something on the top of the name of the show that is not only the world affairs, the world, as I'm explaining, is not just world affairs, is security issues as well, because the world affairs lead to that and vice versa. So let's start with the League of Nations. What was it, how it started, and all that. So we got involved, U.S., in the First World War, and we tipped the scale, definitively tipped the scale towards the Allies in 1917. By 1918, President Wilson, after witnessing the devastation of the war, and it had not ended at that time, you know, the war ended in November 11th, 1918. He delivered a speech and made 14 points, and so that speech is known as the 14-point speech. In January of 1918, to a meeting of Congress, and he put forth his vision of a world that would avoid this devastating global events and bring peace not only to Europe but also to America, because we were affected, and the rest of the world. So at that time, the rest of the world was fighting because the colonial powers, i.e. England, Germany, France, Russia, they had reached around the world, Africa, Asia. So it was a truly global war. So Wilson's point was, let's bring everyone together. And he called the Allies to set some peace terms. And eventually, we'll see that those peace terms were not as, you know, as peaceful as we would expect it, because, you know, the Treaty of Versailles really set us up for World War II. It was too much of a punishing blow to the warring to Germany, and that created the issues of the next chapter in global conflict. So. Wilson, and my point of bringing all of that is that we looked as an up and coming power at that point. We looked and we stood back and looked at the whole world and say, how can this be? How can we improve it? So Wilson starts it, and then in the closing of World War One, the parties come together. They were obviously many countries in Europe, and they create what they call the League of Nations. It was an international diplomatic group developed after the war to solve the disputes before they erupt to become war. So the nations came together with the understanding that if we step ahead of conflicts and we diffuse them, we will have a better chance of long-lasting relationships, and that will develop economies as well. So the League of Nations had an organization. It started in Paris. It went to London. But it was based on the 14 points that Wilson had brought up to the rest of them to share. The League of Nations, though, did not have, although it had the basis of the thought of what we can do, it did not give them the tools to apply when there were conflicts. So there were many conflicts following the end of World War I and before World War II that they were not able to disrupt. Poland at that point, it was fighting with Germany on one side, Russia on the other side about different cities and different states, but this new organization, the League, was not able. It didn't have the power. Didn't have its own army. Didn't have its own authority to step in and solve the problems. So, although you brought up the problem to the League, not much happened. So it had no teeth. It had a status, but it had no teeth. In other examples followed. Those that gave the opportunity to others, including later on to Adolf Hitler, to break away from the League of Nations because they rightly thought that no one is going to bother them. If they do something, who's going to run after them and put them in place? Who will resist them? So it was there, but it wasn't really a secure means of assuring that there will be long-lasting peace. So after that, the World War II, obviously, actually, there was another issue that followed World War I, and it was the issue of the mandates. The mandates followed with the League of Nations that they were territories and countries, not just territories, but countries, that after the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East and the German Empire that included some Asian and some African countries or territories, they were by themselves. They were now freed, but they were not able to just survive by themselves. So the Allies spread out that mandate to protect them and to oversee their function. And the Levant, which is the Syrian area, Iraq, in that it was split between the British and the French. The U.S. was involved as well in the Persian side, in the Iran side. So all of these mandates actually helped to stay the previous colonization of the world and didn't resolve a lot of issues. As a matter of fact, the Palestinian issue, because of these mandates, was brewing. So it was becoming an issue with the to-be-established state of Israel. So fast forward to the interwar years and the beginning of World War II, FDR was faced with the same dilemma. And it was obvious to him that something needed to happen, and well before the end of the war, well before the war had ended in World War II, he was in conferences with Winston Churchill, with Russians, to see how they will stop the Axis powers, i.e. the Japanese, the Germans, and the Italians. So London, unbeknownst to me, I just read it more recently, during World War II and during the attack by the Germans in London, it was the seat of about 22 countries from Europe that sought refuge to London, including the French, so that they can establish a government and not capitulate. They lost their land, but they haven't lost their nation and their country. So the word of coming together and resisting these aggressors, it started to be created in London in about 1941. So the Europeans, including other countries in from obviously Great Britain, they had the Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders, South Africans, but included Belgium, Czechoslovakia back then, Greece, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Norway, Poland, Yugoslavia back then. They got together in a palace called the St. James Palace in London, and they made a declaration that and I'm going to read the quote, that the only true basis of enduring peace is the willing cooperation of free peoples in a world in which, relieved of the menace of aggression, all may enjoy economic and social security, and that it is in their intention to work together and with other free peoples, both in war and peace, to this end. So this is now the beginning, and now FDR picks up this idea, and now they're going to call it the Atlantic Charter, because now having the U.S. on the other side, the common lake in between them was the Atlantic. So they started to call it the Atlantic Charter in 1941. And Winston Churchill got together with FDR in many occasions, and the discussion has started. Later on, the phrase United Nations was actually an American-made name. That was coined by Roosevelt. And in 1942, about 26 states that they were resisting the Axis power, including the U.S. and the U.K., China, and USSR back then, subscribed to this common program with a basic principle, which was based on the Atlantic Charter before, which was based on St. James, is to resist aggression and bring peace. So that was the basis now of the United Nations, that it was discussed during Moscow and Tehran conferences, the Yalta conference during World War II, while FDR was alive and meeting with other leaders. And then in 1944 to 1945, it started to take the real bones about how to go about establishing the principles and actually the details of the United Nations. So in 1945 in San Francisco, after a long exchange of documents and people, many representatives of these 50 or so countries got together from April to June of 45 in San Francisco, and they hammered out what we call today the UN Charter, the United Nations Charter. And that has a series of articles that speak about security, speak about peace, all of the issues that they were available to them to have long-lasting peace. And this charter was ratified by the powers to be at that time: China, France, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, the United States. So it became now, it has been up and around for 80 years, and it's the go-to multilateral. And it has so many other functions around it, you know, including sustainability, humanitarian aid, obviously peace and security, protection of human rights, upholding the international law. So the United States was the principal maker of this and the principal supporter of this, because our country was not devastated, so we didn't live the actual destruction that happened in Japan or in Italy or in Germany or in France or in England. So we had a better opportunity to look at it from the 30,000, 40,000 feet, look down and see what can we do and how to establish it. So the establishment of the UN was a major, major issue. And Article 5 of the UN is actually the Security Council. And the Security Council is the principal tool that the UN has to provide stoppage of a conflict before it erupts to much bigger conflict. So there are a couple of chapters, the Chapter 5 and Chapter 6 talk about Security Council, and then the Pacific Settlement of Disputes. So there are 19 chapters and many amendments since then, and all of the, I think there are 193 countries that they were, or 163 countries, maybe someone can check me on that, that participate in the UN. And the United States gave them deeded land in New York permanently for the establishment of the physical seat of the UN. And that's where they meet annually, actually twice annually. And all the powers come together, and everybody has the right to speak. And you see, even our enemies or frenemies, they have an opportunity to go to the UN Assembly and state their case. So, the most importantly on the Security Council, it's a structure that was established with FDR's input at that time. He wanted to include the actual powers that they were in the conflict on the Allied side, not the Axis side. So none of them were included originally. Eventually, they were admitted, but the original members of the Security Council were not any of the Axis. So FDR at that point, other than the United Kingdom and France, that they were devastated from the war and they were very weakened. Their acceptance was because they suffered so much. The USSR was admitted because it was a large country and it was part of the victory. And at that time, they can see the different socioeconomic systems that they were on either side of the Atlantic between us and the USSR, and they were obviously a power to be reckoned with, and they would have been admitted. China, though, it was a question. China was totally devastated from the war with the Japanese, was assisted by the United States, but it didn't have much to offer back then. It didn't, other than a large population and poverty. So FDR was thinking that we should include someone from the Western Hemisphere, and Brazil was coming into play. Large country, not part of the war. It would represent the Western Hemisphere along with the U.S. So it was not. It was a very good candidate, but finally he settled with his cabinet to admit China because again China paid the price. Paid the price, and it was befitting for them to be included in the United States in the UN Security Council. Now, these are the five permanent members that they have full veto power, meaning that if any one of the five vetoes one of the decisions in the session, then there's nothing you can do. So, and that's the gridlock. That's the gridlock. And then later on, I will talk about a paper that I wrote at Columbia, how to fix that, because we're not getting much out of the functions of the UN and the Security Council in particular. So the how it's structured beyond the five permanent members, then there are another 10 members that they are, in addition to five, that go into a rotation. I believe it's a two-year rotation. So these are voted in, and it's an honor, it's a privilege, it's a distinction to be in the Security Council on those 10 countries that they rotate. So if you have done the rotation, right now I think about 50 countries so far have done the rotation, they gain a lot of experience from that, and they get to vote on a lot of things. Now, in the current conflict, where a permanent member of the UN Security Council is the aggressor to a smaller country, what do you do? Have you heard of any conversations from the UN Council on Russia, how to stop them, to put any language, any decisions that they need to cease this aggression? Well, that hasn't happened. Funny that hasn't happened, because if you're a permanent member, the veto power is there. So that's why I wanted to later on tell you some of my ideas of some changes there. So if we now, the UN obviously has so many other chapters, and the governments, all of these governments, collect funds and donate to the UN in order to run its functions. And there are many. I mean, the budgets are huge. They're global. They have humanitarian aid everywhere around the world. For example, now in Turkey and Syria, it is a much bigger issue than it ever was. So the Security Council, in our current days, includes small countries like Albania, Brazil is in, Ecuador, Gabon, Ghana, Japan, Malta, Mozambique, Switzerland, UAE, United Arab Emirates. So every time there is a vote, we have a permanent representative, a very senior diplomatic position, from us. If you remember Bolton during the Trump years, he was our representative there. They spoke. If you recall, in 2003, we made a presentation to the council for our proposed war to get the Iraqi Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. We made a presentation to the council. So these countries vote. So we now have to deal with little Albania that may have a different opinion because they see the world in a different way, or Ecuador. So Malta, it's not just Brazil. It is all of the small countries that will make a difference. So this is a interesting group, and they provide the major decisions that affect the world. Moving on from the Security Council, the couple of papers that I wrote back in 2018. The reason that it doesn't work, and there were so many instances that it was just not fair how the outcomes came out to be from the Security Council. My suggestions were as a note to the chairman of the United Nations. It was to offer structural reforms, and here they are. There are five bullets. Reduce the full veto-able permanent members from five to three. Now, at that time, at that time, it was 2018, I proposed to keep U.S., Russia, and China as the full veto powers and take it away from France and the U.K. Well, I may change my mind on those. I will not name who they are, but this should be reduced. Now, we create another category, a level two category for the permanent members that they are not in the top three. Then to increase the permanent members of the Security Council to eight instead of five, and we should include countries like India, Japan, maybe Germany. I mean, they're so pacifist, and they haven't been involved in the war. They're afraid of their own shadow, even to give their own weapons out for somebody else to fight. But they're big enough power, economic power, that they should be able to produce. Japan is a sleeping giant. Japan has the technology to produce its own nuclear weapons, so they don't have to rely on our platforms to do it, where Germany does. Obviously, India is a powerful country with the largest population in the world. This should be included. We should increase the elected members from 10 to 15. Make it more dilutive. Make it inclusive. Dilute the 10 that were there to 15. It will add more countries in. And also now to create an apprenticeship of observers, that they are there in order to get their feet wet of how it works, because it takes experience to do it. Not every country has a diplomatic experience to step in and become a member. It takes a long time to do it, but set up a process to do that. So that's part of what I was thinking. And that hopefully it will come, because now we're looking at Russia that is gridlocking the system, and potentially China will gridlock the system with Taiwan. So is that fair? The system, does the system work that we set up? The whole point of, as I lead towards the general discussion back to why we want to make sure that these things work, is because there's one player, and one player only at this time, that is trying to upend the system, trying to change it, trying to make it their own or bring their own and try to take away the existing one, namely China. So why do they want to do that? How are they going to do that? And if they're going to be successful? We're going to discuss that a little later. So the other organizations that are as a creation of the UN was the World Bank Organization. So the World Bank Organization, along with the WTO, the IMF, it was created around the same time as the UN in 1946. And it was as a result of a meeting that happened at Bretton Woods. And it established a system, a financial world system, of how to transfer funds, collect funds, develop the underdeveloped world, or reconstruct the damaged world. So that was part of bringing the powers, the financial powers, together of the system. The other organizations that resulted from that, obviously, the International Monetary Fund, is the same concept, and it is equally successful as part of the UN specialized agency founded in Bretton Woods conference in 1944, and it secures an international monetary cooperation, so the governments can cooperate in order to have bigger and more effect in stabilizing currencies, exchange rates, liquidity issues, access issues, those kind of things. So beyond the financial system, and obviously the United States is very powerful on that, because the currency of the world is still the dollar. The energy prices are still paid in dollar. Obviously, China and Russia, they're trying to create their own system. It is very, very difficult. Very difficult, but it's possible, but it will take a long time to do it, and it will take trust to do it. And if a country manipulates its currency for its own gain, and this currency is an international currency, they lose the faith. They lose the trust from the ones using that currency. So that's why our free-flowing dollar it is critical. Other than the application of the Federal Reserve on the interest rates that affect the dollar, there's no direct intervention. Where China has proven to us that it plays around with its currency to its own benefit. So who would trust them to do that if they, in an instance, they reverse their position to the detriment of the rest of the world? So those are critical that we were involved. The other, the International Court of Justice is another major addition to the UN, and it is the only one that is not based in the United States. It's in The Hague. It's in the Netherlands, and that's where the seat of the peace of the it's in the Peace Palace they call it, and that is where the international justice system is, with 15 judges elected every 9 years, and everybody can contribute to the involvement of the justices. Another organization is the World Trade Organization, and that has come to focus lately, especially during the Trump years, that it's not effective. It's definitely not effective. It's not fair that there's theft of property, especially intellectual property, some of the countries exporting are depressing the numbers so they can be cheaper than others. So there is a lot of back and forth, and we have not solved that international trade issue. And we start to become more mercantilistic in our exchanges with others. One more, and I will stop with the multilaterals, is the World Health Organization, and we found that how important it is in the Wuhan, China, emanated COVID-19. How did they react? What did they tell the world? What is their function? How do they declare these epidemics, endemics, pandemics? Very critical organization in the UN. But again, could it be influenced by others? I think it was influenced by China at the beginning, and definitely it's not sitting well on my top of the mind things that need to be fixed. It needs to be strengthened. It needs to be given teeth to take action and take solid action. Now, let's go back to why we're talking about all of these things. Why is those multilaterals so important in the vitality of the world peace? They are tremendously vital. They are very important. They secure the strength of the United States around the world. Not because we made them and we participated in them and we still participate. Our power and influence has been diluted. But we are the backbone of these organizations. And if we step away, it will definitely make them ineffective even more than they are right now. So our participation in every way to continue to strengthen them is to continue with their ability to solve problems and to improve conditions. So I wholeheartedly support improvements in the UN, but I don't see how a Chinese-based system will have such a global influence with such infrastructure that will make this happen. So this is It cannot be duplicated. It can be improved. So everybody's saying that, you know, the 21st century, as we came to the 21st century, the United States was turning the corner. The Pax Americana was diminishing. We're losing steam. We're losing power. Somebody else is coming up. I think it's not that we have lost power, but we have given power to others to come around us. So if it's a zero-sum game and we had 80%, now we have 60, but the other 40 is the distribution of so many others around it. And I don't think it's a zero-sum game. I'm just making an example of what I think it is happening. We have given power and equality to others, smaller countries, to come up and participate in the world's problems and solutions. So, you know, we came out of Afghanistan and Iraq and the al-Qaeda issues, and we came out bruised. We canceled some of the Trans-Pacific agreements. We canceled the Iran agreement. The notion, the taste was that, the end of the American century is coming. I don't think so. I don't think so. With the prior administration, where they approached the realpolitik literally, the world, they looked at it from the power perspective and not from the liberal human rights and multilaterals and global values. They said, listen, no, Mr. Nice Guy, you want to protect, you want us to protect, and I'll pick a country. Germany, do you want us to protect you? We have placed nuclear weapons in your vicinity, in your state, to protect you as an umbrella. We cover that, everybody. They went up in arms. They didn't want nuclear weapons. Well, how else are we going to protect you if we're not going to have them there? We had to ask permission to remove some brigades in 1999 in one war and bring them down to the Middle East. We had to talk to them that we're going to take them and then bring them back. But then again, right now we see how hollow they were in their own security system. They forget about the 2% of GDP. That's just a notion. They let their military degrade. So if we're going to protect you, we want you to participate with us. We're not going to be the only ones out. So we have bases around the world. We're in 50 plus countries around the world. We're not in any way diminishing or going anywhere. So there was a recent article in the journal by Robert Kagan, and that was very recent, like in February, that said challenging the U.S. is a historic mistake. I highly recommend everyone reading that. It is such a beautifully written, simple paper that explains what has happened historically when the U.S. stepped in, World War I, World War II, and later, and made the world much more powerful and self-sustained in their security, and then brings that today to see how China fits into these changes that they want to make and if they're possible to make. So his argument was that the Axis powers, namely Germany, Italy, and Japan, in their time frame, you know, when they were up and coming, in their time frame, they were able to dominate their periphery, their neighborhood. They were the hegemons in their neighborhood. No one was there to challenge them. Now imagine if we were not in isolationist mindset in 1938. Or 1939, where the Czechoslovakian issues were coming up, or the Sudan land south of Germany, or Poland. What would happen if Hitler knew that we would come to their aid? The Polish and the Czechoslovakians knew that the French and the English will come into their rescue. Well, the French and the English knew that the U.S. will come to their rescue because they did that before. It happened before. It can happen again. So If we were not so enclosed into our shores and said, whatever your problem is, you solve it. If we had that opportunity to throw a stick in that equation and say, no, you're not going to do that, do you think that that will have happened, the sequence of war will happen? The same thing happened in Japan. They invaded Manchuria, 1931 or so, but no one stopped them. There wasn't anyone there to stop them. The European powers had retreated. We were the only ones there. So they had a total control of their environment, and they were powers. They had military power, they had industrial power, they had economic power. They were real hegemons. So in this case where China comes in and looks at the world and they have some kind of an economic influence in their environment, in the East, they don't have military control. Although the Nine Dash Line, you know, it happened in 2004. They claimed the South China Sea. They put islands. They made them – the rocks made them islands. They militarized them. They don't have control. We're still there. We're still plying right through the 100 miles that separate Taiwan from China. So China is not in control of that environment. They're not a hegemonic power admitted in all aspects of that, the military, the economic, the diplomatic. They're bullies for sure. To other countries around them. But look what that has created them. Now that has created a resistance against them. The Quad, we talk about the Quad, India, Australia, Japan, United States, and I'm sure we'll add Korea there, South Korea. We now are bunching up together and say, oh, we're going to check you. We're going to check you out. Then we have Japan. Getting out of their own isolationist idea and pacifist idea, and now they will create their own weaponry, including nuclear weapons. I mean, we know they're pacifists, right? So I'm not going to use them against an offensive war. So now they're creating something that they didn't want to, more resistance. And that was not going to upend their plans to change the world. So they're coming in this environment with Taiwan being the center of their attention. But actually Taiwan is just a it's not the point. The global environment is against them, because the multilaterals, the alliances of the world are leaning against them, and they're not ready to take that long-term plunge to become hegemons, even in Asia, never mind a global power. So that is my opinion. This issue will be solved peacefully, not militarily. But we need to have the power to project in order for them to realize that they're going to be up against a wall. Thank you for listening. And I just want to put a plug in for the company that I am Okay, so Hellenic Aluminum Company has sponsored this. And we
this
are
is your
going to
station.
Close, and we'll talk to you next Saturday. Have a good one.
GCH in Greenwich.
USA News, I'm Jeremy Scott. More survivors have been pulled from the rubble of a 7.8 magnitude earthquake.